that kind of intensity, that kind of focus, that kind of discipline should have been, and defence should have been held accountable for this from mid-2009. That was 15 years ago. So has Australia dropped the ball? Have we lost a decade? Yes, at the very least a decade, arguably as much as 15 years.
For more than 30 years, Mike Pezzullo was one of Australia's most senior national security practitioners. Mike began his career as a bureaucrat in the Department of Defence before becoming an advisor to the Foreign Minister as well as to the Leader of the Opposition. In 2017, Mike was appointed Secretary of the Department of Home Affairs, where he oversaw what was probably the most significant transformation of Australia's national security architecture since the war, as well as its most controversial. Mike's style as a bureaucrat was famously elbows out, something that won him both fans and critics. But what all acknowledge is the depth of his strategic vision and his commitment to his country. Mike joined me to discuss China, the Pacific, and the prospects of war in our region. Mike Pezzullo, welcome to Meridian 100.
Hi, Paul.
Mike, you have had a long and storied career in the national security community. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how you got started?
I joined the Defence Department in 1987 as a graduate in their graduate program, spent a bit of time in defence, and then it's always a good idea in a public service to move around a little bit to get some broadening. So I went to Prime Minister and Cabinet. From there, I ended up in the office of the Foreign Minister, who was then Gareth Evans, when Gareth was both the Leader of the Government and the Senate, and in the Senate, obviously. A little bit unusually for a public servant, I then went into opposition with Labor. I switched across to Kim Beazley, who was the Leader of the Opposition. I stayed with Kim up until 2001, the election of 2001, which of course he lost. And then I returned to the Defence Department as a Senior Executive Service Officer, did a number of corporate jobs, and then was honoured to be appointed as the Deputy Secretary during the Defence White Paper of 2009, which I suspect we'll cover.
Yeah, then I might even interrupt you there,
sure,
if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
I understand one of your roles at that time, or your role at that time in the production of the White Paper, was to take it up to Beijing and brief their officials on it before it was actually released. Is that right, and how was it received at the time?
Well, this has been the subject of some public comment, because in a briefing that I gave on that very visit to the American Embassy, regrettably, that cable was, of course, leaked through the WikiLeaks process. And so the record, at least of my account of it, to the American Embassy is on the internet for anyone to see.
Well, I didn't know that.
But in essence, and it's pretty, I can inform your listeners on this podcast that it's a pretty faithful record of what I said to them, and that in turn was a faithful record of what happened. They were not happy. They made their displeasure clear and known. They were particularly perturbed by the sentiment that the prospect of major war in the Pacific, or the Asia Pacific, or the Indo-Pacific was not a term much in use at the time. So, but in any event, war in the Asia Pacific, with the implication being that such a major war would somehow be related to Chinese aggression, was particularly irksome to them. And they let it be known. They engaged in a number of points of discussion that I won't go into a lot of detail about, because that's still subject to the classified diplomatic record, and of course I've got obligations, notwithstanding the fact that a lot of this is described in that cable that I've just mentioned.
And confirmed, the veracity of which you've just confirmed.
Well, indeed, of the account that I gave to the American Embassy, but in terms of what I didn't tell, what wasn't in that cable, and what I otherwise owe a confidence to, I shall maintain. Suffice it to say, the request that they made to engage in some modifications were rebuffed with a very strong backing of Canberra, and obviously with the Prime Minister himself and the senior leadership here. So the White Paper was delivered as written. And all those events transpired in May of 2009.
China of today is very different from the China of 2009. How do you think the Defence Strategic Review, for instance, would have been received up in Beijing had you had the task of briefing them on it?
Well, of course, there's been 14 years of development since that time. And, of course, during that time, you could perhaps say the 2009 White Paper, and I give full credit to Dr. Rudd for his leadership as the Prime Minister in driving the Defence Department and the process hard in the direction that the government ultimately signed off on. Certainly the Defence Department, the ADF, led at the time by Angus Houston, gave our advice, but it's very much the government's document. And frankly, it was both out of its time. It was unusually sharp for its time, but I think history will judge it to be prescient, and certainly more prescient than a lot of the other assessments that were coming down at the time. Remembering this was 3 years before President Xi even came to office, 2009. So this was in the Hu Jintao era. But the concerns that were expressed there about not just the pace and scale of their modernisation, but the design of their modernisation, the types of weapon systems that they were looking to acquire, the operational concepts that they were putting that they were attaching to those weapon systems, to us as we looked at it, only made sense in terms of some kind of potential posturing for maritime air sea combat in the Pacific. Not to say that they want to have such an eventuality come to pass, and nor do the Americans for that matter, but to gear up your force to potentially fight an air and sea battle is significant.
So the strategic trajectory of today, you would say, was evident in embryonic form back in 2009?
It was more than evident, and again, I don't want to place too much credence or too much weight on any kind of clairvoyancy, but it was just simply a reading of the environment, the assessments that we were making. Looking at the design, we're in the Defence Department, so our job was to look less at the diplomatic developments and look at the hard reality of weapon systems, modernisation, capability, coupled, of course, with intent, which is a separate but related question. So, yes, the shoots of that were certainly apparent to us, and the system was generating in China, for whatever reason, and the historians will debate this, a capacity to thwart American power projection into the Western Pacific, for whatever reason and for whatever motivation, and for, you could take the view, well, that's what defence forces do. They generate capability. They generate capability that may or may not one day be used. It's about providing the political leadership with options. Absolutely correct. But we're in the Defence Department, so our job was to look at precisely that. What is this capability potentially going to give them options to do? What could it be for, whether it's Taiwan or some other scenario? Not long after, their aggression and assertiveness in the South China Sea became more evident. You might recall as early as 2010, they were starting to militarise, particularly in the Spratlys and the Paracel Islands. And again, 2 years before the current political leadership took over in 2012, then it obviously accelerated and intensified thereafter. And more have come to the view that even if, and I don't think anyone would claim that there's an inevitable conflict coming, or that war is already, if you like, set and determined, but the prospect of military conflict arises, certainly when you've got one party thinking that it's got options that it could execute, and it therefore calculates its challenges, its chances for success. If you didn't have those capabilities, you couldn't make those calculations.
Well, just on that question of the prospect of conflict, you famously, or infamously, I should say, penned an email back in 2021, where you warned that the drums of war, quote unquote, were beating. Mm. That was widely interpreted at the time as a warning that war with China was looming, if not inevitable. Was that a fair representation or an accurate representation of your view?
No, it wasn't. I had a chance, in brief form at least, to explain the context to the Senate Estimates Committee that met a month or so thereafter. I made it clear that my concern in an email to my staff was the sense that I thought in the West we had retired the notion of major power conflict and major war to the kind of recesses of history. It was something that had happened a long time ago. We rightly venerate the sacrifices of the Anzacs in the First World War, the Second World War, of course, but it was something in our past. And the point of the email, and it was more about the fact that major conflict, not small-scale insurgencies or the sorts of smaller wars, as terrible as they are, frankly, but nonetheless contained wars that we've been experiencing up until that point, Afghanistan being a case in point, wasn't the sole definition of war. The idea of modern militaries clashing, either at land, in the air, at sea, in space potentially, could potentially be in our future. And the point I was making to my staff is that therefore we have to gird ourselves for the possibility of major war. As I said to the Senate when I was asked by a senator, I had just as much in mind the potential for conflict in Europe. Now, and again, this was before the invasion of the Ukraine, reprehensibly by Putin's Russia. So I made no statement or I made no claim in my staff message that war in the Indo-Pacific was either likely, inevitable, or indeed a possibility. It just simply avoided that. It was more about war in general, and is our society ready for the idea that not just reflecting on war in the past, but it's something that we have to potentially consider for the future. And it's just not clear to me that we've got the right mindset, as shocking as that thought as that is. I'm not sure that we've got the right mindset to anticipate that.
Expand on that. What do you mean we don't have the right mindset?
If you're bordering the conflict with Ukraine, so just last week or recently at least, the Polish Prime Minister talked about war is no longer an abstraction. Mm. We can't just simply say it's a conceptual concern. War is very real, and we might well be in the pre-war period. Other European leaders, and indeed both political and military leaders, have talked about the immediacy of the prospect of war. Mm. That is the war in the Ukraine spilling across borders, and you've seen significant investments in military modernisation, civil defence preparedness in the Baltics and the Scandinavian countries, famously Sweden long neutral and Finland joining NATO and all the rest of it. And of course, quite separately, there's the concern of conflict in the Middle East spilling out beyond Israel, Gaza, and you've got flashpoints at various parts of the Indo-Pacific.
But here in Australia?
We're further back. None of those conflicts are on our frontier. So if you're in the Baltics, if you're in Scandinavia, if you're in Eastern Europe, you feel it. If you're in the Middle East, in places like Jordan, in Egypt, in Syria, you would feel just simply in the air that there's a tension, that there's a possibility of war escalating and you're waking up to missiles flying through the air and bombs being dropped and all the rest of it. In the Indo-Pacific, it's actually reasonably quiet at the moment. It's relatively, compared to those two theatres at least, certainly benign in relative terms. But some of the flashpoints here are quite concerning too. You've got what's happening at the second Thomas Shoal with the resupply of the Philippine ship being interdicted constantly by the Chinese. You've seen the competing patrols there at sea in the Western Pacific. In the Western Philippines, I should say, there's obviously the unresolved question, and it's on lots of people's mind, everyone's mind, about Taiwan. But you've also got unresolved territorial disputes and differences between Russia and Japan in what Japan calls its northern territories. Mm. Occasionally, you've got Kim Jong-un rattling the sabre in the Koreas and so on and so forth. And it's only just a year or so ago that Chinese and Indian troops came to lethal blows up in the Himalayas. All of those concerns, mercifully, are several steps removed from Australia. We're further back. There are several degrees of strategic separation between Australia and all those conflicts or potential flashpoints for conflict. And I think quite properly, because in a democracy, in a liberal democracy, we place higher store on the pursuit of happiness, of increasing our wealth, and we shouldn't be concerned. You know, we shouldn't have the concern of war just artificially or synthetically drummed up. The question in my mind would it be possible on some scenarios that I can contemplate to hold all of those forces at bay without them somehow reaching down and affecting us here in Australia? That's what I'm getting at, and that's what concerns me.
And what do you think on that question?
Well, in some scenarios, I think I said a moment ago, I think it's relatively benign, and I'm
let's, sorry, just before you get into that, why don't we go through it a little bit more systematically?
Sure.
I mean, the main threat, the main question in the region is China, its strategic intentions, and the prospect of conflict, most likely, but not exclusively, over Taiwan. How high do you rate the prospect of conflict over Taiwan, high-intensity conflict of the sort you've just described, over Taiwan in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's unlikely, and I think it's not so unlikely, though, that we shouldn't be worried. I'm not going to put a particular numerical value on it, but I think it's more likely than not that war won't break out.
Why is that?
Because I just think that the guardrails, such as they are, the tempering of sort of aggressive passions, even if you've got a circumstance akin, let's say, just for historical analogy's sake, akin to, say, a Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, forces are deploying, ships are starting to deploy. I just think that at that time, whoever's in the White House and whoever's calling the shots in Beijing, and it could be on the watch of President Xi, it could be sometime down the track, the thought that you would recklessly and, you know, with indifference to the risk of escalation, start lightly employing military force. I just think that that would be a natural break at that point. Now, you would hope that many other diplomatic safeguards and breaks and checks and balances would have come into play, that there would have been talks, there would have been attempts to take the heat out of the issue, there would have been attempts to deflect any kind of looming crisis. I'm saying even if you get to that point where ships are deploying, you've sort of got a Berlin standoff a la 61 or you've got a Cuban standoff a la 62, even at that point, because of the likelihood that one or the other side would at some point start to consider the use of nuclear weapons, I think that would give everyone pause for thought. Now, that said, terrible wars have still broken out, even when all of those calculations have been taken into account. Of course, we've ended up in major calamitous wars, even for all of that. I'm more optimistic than perhaps you might assume, Paul, that I think those breaks would work. That said, there is a chance that they wouldn't.
What about when the strategic balance shifts, as it's predicted to shift in the next 5 to 10 years in Beijing's favour, and it can take, potentially, Taiwan quickly and effectively and possibly before the Americans can...
I'm not sure
whether or not that would change China's strategic calculations and balance of risk.
I think if events were to unfold in the way your question is premised, then if the cost is low enough and the risk is attractive enough relative to the reward, of course, what's premised in your question, a quick lightning strike or some kind of quick sudden strike might well make sense. However, the United States, Japan, Australia, one would think, Korea and others would not just simply be looking at those developments indifferently. They would be making their own calculations, particularly if a blockade or some kind of enforcement of an air identification zone more easily mounted than a full-scale invasion, even if the invasion, hypothetically, let's say, if it was to be mounted, might start with small-scale raids before a D-Day type amphibious operation, incredibly difficult to mount, very, very challenging. It takes a very long lead time to put troops in place, to get the material in place, to get the landing craft in place. I can't imagine for a moment, irrespective of who's in the White House, that those developments would just simply unfold without any kind of response. They could be diplomatic warnings, there could be back-channel discussions, there could well be mobilisation and some posturing of units to start to seek to send deterrent signals. I just don't think that one day we'll wake up and all of a sudden the balance has changed and the Chinese leadership say, right, we're good to go now. It would be a layered, graduated, incrementally changing set of circumstances between now and the point at which you described in the premise of your question.
The outcome you've described, which is the happy outcome that we all hope for, that cooler heads prevail and the Chinese decide that the risk is not worth the reward, that all depends, doesn't it, on China accepting the status quo ante in relation to Taiwan. And effectively, they wouldn't ever explicitly acknowledge it, but they would be required to implicitly and effectively acknowledge that Taiwan will remain a free and independent state.
Possibly not. And
I mean, how do you get around it?
Well, at the moment... and it's Chinese policy, it's declared Chinese policy to seek the reunification. And so at some point...
I'll stop you there at the risk of being... you've probably never been to Taiwan, being an Australian official. I've been to Taiwan. Yeah. They're not for turning.
They're not for turning, but it's not entirely clear in not being for turning whether they would themselves provoke a calamity by declaring independence either. Now, that would change the game. I mean, obviously, if you had a regime or a formal declaration of independence, then that... But again...
Force their hand, of course. But they'll never do that.
Right.
Well, unlikely to do that.
Unlikely. Okay, so you've got, on the one side, a reunification. Ostensibly, I mean, the declared policy remains peaceful reunification. That's the declared policy. You've got Taipei accepting that the status quo at the moment could not be altered by way of an independence declaration without calamitous consequences. And you've got the United States, by and large, President Biden occasionally quite sharply says it's a declared policy of the US that they would intervene. Mm. The accepted position, I think, is that it's assumed that the Americans would intervene in some way, shape or form. So if the premise of your question is, does China have to accept that or for peace to be maintained, does China have to accept an unsatisfactory status quo
indefinitely?
Indefinitely, Probably not, but what's unsatisfactory about it? So at the moment, it's in China's gift, it's in Beijing's gift, because you've certainly got both parties in Taipei and all sides in Taipei are keen to engage in dialogue, cross-strait trade, investment, people-to-people links. There's been positive developments in the more distant past. There's no reason to think that that just simply can't continue to prevail. And then, yes, at some point, because everyone agrees on one China, right? Australian policy is one China, Beijing's policy is one China. They've got a particular view about how Taiwan should be integrated as effectively a province, ultimately under a reunification approach. The Americans accept one China. They have ever since Nixon's change of US policy. So we all accept one China. Most of us, and I think it's Chinese policy as well, don't accept that status quo be changed through war. There's no reason for that circumstance not to be continued, if not indefinitely. I mean, who knows how long the future is. But why can't that just simply continue to prevail? If the alternative is some kind of cross-strait conflict, which I dare say would be very difficult to contain to be in a cross-strait conflict. If the US were to intervene and forces have been deployed and shots are being fired, it certainly would be open to then both sides to escalate both horizontally and potentially vertically with ever more impactful weapon systems being used. So any war over Taiwan isn't necessarily just a war over Taiwan. It becomes a war in the Pacific. And that's why I say we certainly would hope the cooler heads would prevail. But I think reasonable people would say, hang on, this is not necessarily going to end up in a good place for either of us or indeed any of us.
Well, on the subject of reasonable people, there is, and I use the term ironically, there is a strong possibility, if not a probability, that we will see a return to the White House of Donald Trump. Mm. How will the United States' approach to constraining China alter potentially under a reborn Donald Trump administration?
I'll take the question back to front by looking at the strong continuity in many policy settings between President Biden and President Trump. The Trump administration did not commence with a overly sharp view of what it needed to do about China, but by golly, by the end, particularly with some technology decisions, 5G, which a lot of technology decoupling, and if not decoupling, certainly de-risking, the Trump administration did nothing other than maintain its security commitments, implied and otherwise, to Japan and Korea. Yes, there was discussion about burden sharing and paying increased costs and all the rest of it. The Biden administration actually maintained a lot of those settings. So if Mr. Trump then comes back, there's been, in my view, even though they might have a disagreement at a partisan level about who was better on policy and who had the better policy, I see more continuity between Trump 1.0, Biden's policy to Asia-Pacific, you know, with Kurt Campbell's leadership in the NSC up until recently, prior to his appointment as the Deputy Secretary of State. So if Trump were to come back, if he was going to maintain continuity with himself, there'd actually be a lot of continuity with Biden. Now, there'd be some issues around the cost of American deployments. The former president, potentially prospectively future president, has made the not unreasonable point that it's not equitable for the Americans to be spending 3%, 4%, sometimes 5% of GDP on defence and underwriting European and Asian security when some nations there are spending barely above 1% of GDP. A point that not just Mr. Trump has made. I mean, I remember Bob Gates, when he was Secretary of Defence under Obama, fulminating at a couple of Munich security conferences about inequitable burden sharing with the Europeans in that case. So not an unreasonable point for the Americans to be making, whether they're Republicans or Democrats.
One of the key developments to occur during your time in government, towards the end of your time in government, I should say, was the AUKUS arrangement, the trilateral agreement between Australia, the UK and the United States. In 2 short years, it has evolved significantly, and there is now serious talk that Japan looks set to dock in as an AUKUS partner. That has been received for the most part quite favourably, I think it's fair to say, but I wonder whether or not that is premature, given that AUKUS itself is still in its embryonic phases and information sharing between the three partner countries is anything but bedded down. What's your view?
Setting aside the question of timing just for a moment, so starting with the principle, I think in terms of what's called Pillar 2,
yes, which is advanced capabilities.
Advanced capabilities, Japanese technology undervalued and underappreciated in a number of those areas: artificial intelligence, autonomous systems, precision, long-range systems, undersea systems, quantum. They're doing a lot of work both within government, within their private sector, and also in terms of public-private partnerships. That would be very, very attractive and useful if it was to be shared in some kind of technology construct, a Western technology construct of some description.
But I think that point's been perhaps overlooked in some of the commentary, is that Japan would be, if you like, an exporter within an exporter of technology and capability.
In some areas, world-leading or close to world-leading. As extensive as the American research, scientific and technology and engineering establishment is, it's not the monopoly provider or if you like, the monopoly holder of all innovation in this area.
Where does Japan have the most to contribute? Where are they ahead?
I think in some of the computing areas that they've looked at, particularly in light of what happened with 5G, in looking at encryption, in looking at quantum, they are, in some cases, world-leading. If not world-leading, then close to being world-leading, and certainly peer. Their work on all of the areas of technology, including undersea and autonomous systems, is first rate. Now, they've got particular historical and other restrictions on their ability to share that that technology. So AUKUS would be a way to, in a structured and methodical way, to work through all the technology transfer issues, the export control issues, the intellectual property issues. There is a timing issue, which has been picked up in the commentary, that some of the research that pertains to those areas is, if not open university research, it's pretty open. Papers are published, universities collaborate and the like. But the operationalisation and, dare I say, weaponisation of some of those technologies has to be held very tightly within very strictly controlled technology transfer, intellectual property, export control systems, and that actually requires a lot of work to put in place. That's to do with security clearances, it's to do with ensuring that your systems cannot be hacked, it's to do with personnel, physical, cyber and other security measures. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. The Japanese have recognised that. They've long recognised for some years, ever since the late Shinzo Abe, when he was Prime Minister, came to the realisation that they need to get their own house in order in that respect. They've been putting a lot of work into those domestic security settings that you would need to create the right infrastructure to share the most sensitive and indeed what would become classified elements of those technologies.
Canada and New Zealand have also publicly expressed the desire to join AUKUS in some form or another and at some point in the future. Is AUKUS morphing into a semi-formal or even a formal security alliance whose principal aim, explicit aim nearly, is to contain China?
I don't think so, and certainly not beyond anything that the Chinese themselves were already have assessed to be of concern, and that is that you've got a US-led, Western, to use that term loosely, technology partnership that's just going to further embed and entrench ways in which to develop advanced systems in a way they find very difficult. So a lot of their developments have to be in-house. They share some of these to some extent with the Russians, but that's about it. So the leveraging effect that the West can have, whether it's Japan or you bring in Canada, you bring in New Zealand, potentially others, the leveraging effect that you have in terms of research, development, science, technology and engineering is a multiplier that they don't have access to. So that's good. Is it a security alliance, formal or otherwise, that is, if you like, constraining?
Or is that the direction of travel is really the question?
The sheer fact that you're developing systems and capabilities that are in themselves, once deployed, deterrence. As those capabilities develop in the West and they're afforded and they're shared by the US, UK, Australia, potentially Japan, potentially others, it makes the Chinese strategic challenge harder. It puts pressure on them because they can't be entirely certain of the level of capability that they're facing and the level of capability that might well take what they think are their advantages off the table by neutralising those advantages. So that'd be a matter of concern to the Chinese. Is it a sort of embryonic NATO or an embryonic security alliance, to use the phrase I think you used, was to constrain? Well, no, because there's no political overlay that says if one party's attacked, then others have got obligations. If one party's attacked, then others have to at least consult. I think it would be fanciful, whether you did through AUKUS or through any other mechanism, to have a NATO-style collective security arrangement in the Indo-Pacific or more particularly the Western Pacific. The history is different, the cultures are different, the societies are different, the strategic circumstances are different.
The central pillar of AUKUS is, of course, the acquisition of nuclear submarines. Yep. The first leased boat won't arrive until the 2030s, and we won't start producing them here domestically until, I think, the 2040s. Has Australia stuffed this up?
By this, do you mean the
submarine
program?
We're talking about unacceptable delays and potential capability gaps, because we'll have a Collins-class boat, but by that stage we'll be nearly half a century.
So what you're speaking about is the submarine capability writ large, and there have been a number of different iterations of how to take Australia to the next level of capability in that regard, including the contract with the French, which of course was then voided, and then now AUKUS. I can now speak a little bit more freely without getting into classified matters or where I've got confidentiality obligations. But as a private citizen, I can say this, and I'll say it for the first time on your podcast, that I think it's to be regretted, and history I think will be a harsh judge, that the direction of travel that was set out in that white paper that we spoke about earlier, which would have seen 12 advanced conventional submarines starting to be deployed in about the late 2020s into the early 30s, that would have been a natural stepping stone. Whether we consider it or not is something that I'm not at liberty to discuss, because until the cabinet papers are released in another 5 or so years' time, it won't be evident as to whether the nuclear option was considered at the time, and I'm not going to divulge
of course,
that.
Of course.
However, if you're taking a step back, looking at the direction of travel that subsequently has occurred, you could have gone to Collins, the 09, I call it the 2009 submarine, because they still would have been quite new, then would have had a mixed fleet to then look at options like mixing it with Virginias and then ultimately mixing it with successor nuclear boats. That would leave us in a much better state than we find ourselves, with the workhorses, the Collins workhorses, having to be extended and 50 years old by the operative time. So I was the lead author of the 2009 white paper. In the end, it wasn't my policy. It's the policy of the Rudd government. So ministers certainly signed off on it. But more than signed off on it, this was something that Dr. Rudd believed in passionately. He thought that the country needed to start to modernise the force. And it's to be remembered that the force set out in that white paper was called Force 2030. So again, the prescience, and this is us looking at issues in 2008, 2009, not after the elevation of Xi in 2012 and what's transpired since. The prescience, I think, will be well respected and well regarded over time as the historians look at it. And in addition to the submarines, of which there were 12 advanced conventional boats set out there, which should have been proceeded with, the delays, the obfuscation, the constant reviews, going back over old ground, retracing your steps, I think, and I'm going to say this now as a private citizen, was deeply regrettable. We should have, once we'd signed up as a nation to that enterprise in 2009, there just should have been a DSR type laser-like focus that is now in evidence with the bringing down of the DSR that was presented to government by Stephen Smith and Angus Houston. That kind of intensity, that kind of focus, that kind of discipline should have been, and defence should have been held accountable for this from mid-2009. That was 15 years ago. So has Australia dropped the ball? Well,
stuffed up was the term I used.
That's the term you used. I'm not going to be quite so pungent. But have we lost a decade? Yes, at the very least a decade, arguably as much as 15 years. That white paper was 15 years ago. Didn't have all the solutions. You would have had to have modified, calibrated.
A lost decade, and that's putting it in best case scenario,
best,
correct?
Yeah.
A lost decade in the present strategic circumstances is gravely serious, is it not?
I think it's deeply regrettable.
Is deeply regrettable the term?
I still haven't been retrained, Paul.
Speak freely now, Mike.
I've still got the rounded and more moderated language of the Mandarin still in me, unfortunately. Look, I think it's deeply regrettable. It's now for history to judge because you can't, you know, there's no time machine that brings you back there. But beyond submarines, the other point I was going to make.
Well, before I let you make that point, what are the consequences of that deeply regrettable lost decade likely to be? Strategic consequences.
Well, the loss of time.
Obviously, loss of time, but are we looking at a potentially catastrophic capability gap?
Well, the kind of force that you need, which is now the force set out in the DSR, and the government's to be commended for bringing that document down. And in fairness to, I haven't lost my bipartisanship either. In fairness to the Morrison government, some of the directions were set out in the strategic update of 2020 as well. But certainly the DSR now is the preeminent vehicle for all of this, and Defence Minister Miles will surely, I gather, be bringing down a further iteration through the National Defence Strategy. The problem that's now being created because of the lost decade, and in my bipartisanship, I'm able to attribute that sense of regret to both the Labor and Coalition governments of that intervening 15 years. It really is a shame because, look, nothing in defence capability is ever set precisely in stone. You would have had to have amended it. You would have had variations. You would have had... Mm. But we've had more than that. We've had constant backtracking, reviews of reviews. And all that means is that you lose another 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, depending on, you know, the nature of the exercise. That time is crucially important. I mean, we fought the Second World War three times over in 15 years, right? So the urgency and the imperative, as the Ukrainians and others are discovering now, that war brings, just can't seem to be brought to bear in peacetime, because the emphasis is on oversight, reviews, let's check the homework again, let's change our mind, let's void this contract, let's do that. Over a decade, you've got to keep resolve and momentum and drive going so that when you need the force, which, you know, presciently you could say it's all those years ago we thought might be relevant from the mid-2020s onwards, it's there at least as a basis to be scaled. Because the other point that was made in the 2009 white paper, which has not subsequently been acted upon in subsequent white papers, and again, both governments have been in office over time, was creating a mobilisation base. So in other words, creating enough of an integrated force that can actually fight the kind of campaign that we might potentially have to fight in a major war. Because again, the 2009 white paper talked about the prospect of major war in the Pacific, and the ADF being prepared to engage in that, not on our own, because any major war in the Pacific is going to be some kind of coalition activity. And then depending on how much warning time you have, how much lead time you have, you scale your force. So you get additional missiles, you get additional torpedoes, you might even get additional platforms if you've got enough time. The proof in the pudding isn't just the 12 submarines that we spoke about all those years ago, but the acquisition of long-range strike. Go back to that document. Centrepiece was long-range strike. And here we are still talking about long-range strike. Now, I know some things have been done, and that's to be commended. But the thing that kills you in strategy, and certainly defence planning, is lost time. And regrettably, we've got too much lost time that one day will have to be accounted for.
What can we do, if anything, just sticking with the submarines for a second, we do, if anything, to make up for that lost time? Are there things we can do to accelerate the acquisition of these submarines, either in their leased form or their...
I just don't follow it closely enough day to day. I know there's been some public commentary about the pace at which the US shipbuilding system can generate Virginias. The production lines can't just simply be magically doubled or tripled. But I'm just not close enough to the detail.
What about, more generally though, what about this fixation, might be too strong a term, but this emphasis on Australian industry content and insisting that complex capabilities like submarines be built in part or completely locally when they can be delivered more quickly and cheaply overseas? Is that an albatross around our neck?
No, for this reason, I think, and this is what the experience of war, where it's actually being fought at scale, is showing, is that you need some critical mass of indigenous capability so you can quickly scale and have the production lines, the ability to quickly scale up. So whether it's guided weapons, whether it's munitions, whether it's components for aircraft or ships, it does depend on the different parts of the defence enterprise that you're speaking of. So if you're in a conflict, aircraft, if you lose one and you know it's beyond repair, you have to get into a queue to try to get into the production line. It doesn't make a lot of sense, as we've seen around the world, to have too many indigenous fighter programs just simply because it's easier to sign up to one fighter program and then just get into the queue for those. But even there, making some components and having the ability to do some local repairs is actually worthwhile doing. Ships are different. you've got fewer of them. If they get damaged, you want to fix them as quickly as possible. Having a shipbuilding industry and having a ship repair industry, one that literally in war can turn around damaged assets quickly, is vital. I'm a big proponent of Australia having a strong shipbuilding and ship repair capability in the way that, for instance, I wouldn't be as strong an advocate of in terms of aircraft production, for instance.
You mentioned, and we've talked a little bit about Ukraine and the conflict in Europe. Talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, there's now a widely held view that that war is, well, not perhaps not lost, but that momentum has decisively shifted away from the Ukrainians and back to Moscow. Is that your assessment as well? And if so, what are the implications for that conflict? How does it end? When does it end? Does it end? Does it finish as a sort of frozen conflict?
I think the greater prospects, absent some overnight shock or surprise, is for a drawn-out campaign that might well become frozen in time. I think President Zelensky himself in recent days has expressed a concern and is advocating for an acceleration of the pipelines, particularly of missiles, of rocketry, shells, wheeled and tracked vehicles. You can keep fighting these long wars of attrition for so long as you gear your industrial back end, your factories, to support the troops at the front. Now, the Ukrainians are also looking at conscription. They're also looking at changing their conscription model and so on and so forth. There is, of course, the question, and you see this played out in terms of congressional debates about how much to provide by way of provision. There is the question of where the arsenal of freedom or the arsenal of democracy is. You know, should it shift to Europe? Should the Europeans take on more of the burden? That seems to be President Macron's sense of being in this for the long haul, whether or not, by implication, the Americans. I think President Biden's made it pretty clear that they're not for walking away, but he's got particular challenges in terms of getting those packages through.
And if there's a change in administration, of course, that.
Well, in recent days, there have been stories that are based on what are said to be good anonymous sources of the thinking within the Trump group about what a resolution might look like, whether that's an accurate reflection of the former president's mind or whether it's people associated with his campaign freewheeling. It's always hard to tell. I think any suggestion that Putin be rewarded, frankly, even with an inch of territory for naked territorial aggression is not just morally reprehensible, but I think strategically unwise.
Well, just again, quickly expand on that. I mean, how would a Russian victory or Western capitulation, if I can put it that way, be interpreted in, say, Beijing?
For my own personal view, I think conceding anything would embolden others who have got, and this is the difference between some of those other wars that I touched on earlier, those smaller wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. The wars that have been fought now have got territorial implications attached to them. We had thought, unlike, you know, before the First World War and the Second World War, that wars over territory, wars over enlarging your territory were a thing of the past. There is so much unsettled business from the Northern Territories of Japan, right through the Senkakus, through Taiwan is an issue all on its own, islands off in the Western Philippines, islands down in and features in the Spratlys and the Paracels, the still unresolved border between China and India in two parts of the Himalayas. I think any suggestion that territorial aggression can be rewarded is to be avoided, and certainly any signal that Beijing might derive that, look, if you either get it quickly enough or you're prepared to stay for the long haul so that you wear down any kind of coalition of resistance and you eventually get everything, that is, in my mind, the nightmare scenario.
I'll ask you finally, Mike, about the Pacific. There is, of course, a ferocious contest of influence being waged in the Pacific between Australia, the United States and China. And I think it's fair to say the US were quite alarmed at the, well, not so recent security pact now signed in the Solis that occurred when you were in the chair. You'd be well aware of just how perhaps angry the Americans were. I think there was a degree of animus directed towards Australia that this had happened, that they felt a degree of surprise at this. Talk to me a little bit about the nature of that competition. What will China's footprint in, say, 5 to 10 years look like in the region? Are we winning that contest for influence? Are we losing it?
I think we underestimate our own level of agency, influence and presence in the South Pacific. It's a long way from China. We're local. We're here on the ground. China, for all sorts of reasons that we've touched on, is spread across a number of different areas. They've got concerns all around their periphery. They've got global issues that they're engaged with. And, of course, they've got domestic pressures and problems at home. That said, scale gives them the ability to put, in their relative terms, not much of an investment on the table, to create measures of concern such as the ones that you described. I think we've got, though, more leverage and more influence, in part because we do business differently. I think we're valued differently. I think we're valued with the occasional misstep, sometimes involving our own actions and sometimes those of others, subject to us not offending sovereignty, behaving arrogantly rather than with some, you know, degree of humility. Given that a lot of these states obviously were former colonies, there are sensitivities about colonial attitudes and behaviours. As long as we understand, which I think we do very deeply, and there are some people in the Australian system who are just deeply, deeply steeped in the Pacific and they know it very, very well, I think we've got cause to be more optimistic than we sometimes are.
Mike Pezzullo, thanks for joining us on Meridian 100.
Thank you so much, Paul.
That was Mike Pezzullo. I'm Paul Maley. Please join me next week on Meridian 100. And if you like this episode, please remember to subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.